having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050721, SSP Partners and Metro Novelties, Inc. versus Gladstrong Investments USA Corporation from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. 050882, Harry Homes, a joint venture, Homeowners Multiple Equity, Inc. and Warranty Underwriters Insurance Company versus Robert E. Cole and S. Jane Cole from Tarrant County and the 2nd Court of Appeals District. And docket number 051023, Montgomery County, Texas versus David Park from Montgomery County and the 10th Court of Appeals District. The court is allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to conclude all three before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050721, SSP Partners and Others versus Gladstrong Investments USA Corporation.
May it please the court, Mr. Roger Hughes and Ms. Jennifer Henderson will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Hughes will open with the first 8 minutes. Mr. Hughes will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Metro Novelties. Ms. Henderson is here on behalf of SSP Partners. We intend today to focus on the statutory indemnity question. I, with the court's permission, will focus on liability based on the apparent manufacturer doctrine. Ms. Henderson will focus on the question of liability under the single business enterprise doctrine. The trial court here denied a retailer and a distributor common law and statutory indemnity against Gladstrong USA for a defective foreign-made product, even though under federal law, Gladstrong USA is deemed to be the manufacturer. It held itself out to be the manufacturer of this product.
To whom?
I'm sorry?
To whom did it hold itself out as the manufacturer?
It held itself out first to the world, but second to the marketing chain.
How to the world? I mean, my understanding, the argument's been made that there needs to be consumer confusion in order for the apparent manufacturer doctrine to apply. And would you agree that there's no consumer confusion here?
No, I wouldn't agree that for two reasons. First, the basis for the doctrine is not actual confusion, but potential confusion. And secondly, Mr. Lee clearly testified in his deposition that this was a business strategy on their part to make distributors think that they were the manufacturer.
But who's the consumer here? Is there anything on the lighter that would indicate that USA was the manufacturer?
Well, two things. First, the way it is marked, it says Wax brand lighter on it. That's stamped on the metal part. And secondly, printed on it is the Gladstrong UPC number, which is unique to Gladstrong. The way these are marketed is that U.S. only Gladstrong makes these kind of lighters, that is Wax brand. Second, in the United States, the only people that can and do sell these are its exclusive importer and exclusive distributor, which is Gladstrong USA. If you want a Wax brand lighter, you have to call their office. That's the only office that you can call.
But you're presuming the consumer is the distributor. I mean, is the one who purchases from the distributor and not the ultimate consumer who buys it at the store?
I understand what the court is saying, but in this case, they're one and the same. The box that is delivered to the store comes from them. It has their UPC. It has their brand name on it. I mean, the way it's marketed to everyone is that Wax is a Gladstrong product, and it has their mark on it. And I can understand what the court is saying is the consumer itself may not know whether it's a Gladstrong lighter or a Bic or a Scripto. But the purpose here is of this whole tactic is to make the marketing chain, the people who buy from them, believe it's their product. That was Mr. Lee's saying was that he intended this strategy to induce the people who come to them to buy to think they were dealing with the manufacturer, so that they would think they were dealing.
Well, I guess my question is, if you needed to show consumer confusion by the purchaser, the ultimate end user, if that were a required element of the apparent manufacturer doctrine, would you lose?
If it were consumer confusion,
because I understand you're saying you don't need that, but if it were determined that you did need end user confusion, would you lose in this case on that theory?
Perhaps on this record, but the point is that the time it came up, they didn't make an issue of this. I mean, the way the restatement articulates the rule, it is not necessarily that the consumer is in fact confused, but that there is the potential for confusion. You don't have to prove it in fact, because as the restatement makes clear, the actual confusion is not, it's presumed. You can't walk away. It's so to speak, a conclusive estoppel argument, if you will.
What would be the confusion to the ultimate consumer? They're getting a lighter. It serves as a functional purpose. It's not like they're wanted a Volvo and got a Ford.
Well, the confusion is that as the restatement that says, the confusion is that the product is bought based on the implied representation of quality and the implied representation that because it's my product, I stand behind it. Now, that, in fact, is what is being told to the distributing chain, because that's the whole purpose of the stratagem, and that's the purpose of putting it on the website. And so it's the it's not merely some sort of breach of warranty theory. It's rather a theory that by putting your name behind the product, you are somehow inducing people to buy the product.
Is there any evidence that Gladstrong itself was the manufacturer of the lighter? Gladstrong USA was the manufacturer or not?
In the loose sense of the word, one would say not, except because there's a federal statute that makes them the manufacturer, because they are the exclusive importer. The problem is that under the statute, we also include the word producer, which under some definitions includes ones who exhibits, brings forth, etc.
So which could also be any innocent retailer in the supply chain, I suppose.
In this case, I would say not, because they hold themselves out to be that way, and the federal law makes them the manufacturer. And I guess one would have to say we have to take them, we have to work within the definition of the way they work in the trade itself. You can't, both sides agree, you cannot take these terms in a vacuum. You have to take them in the way they're used in the trade. And in the trade, the producer would be the person who basically introduces the product to the entire market. And in that sense, because they are in bringing it into the market, which is the entire United States, they would be the producer, but not, say, the second or third tier.
But under that theory, wouldn't it be possible in another case for an importer who makes no representations about closeness with the manufacturer or holding themselves out as a manufacturer, that innocent importer would be an indemnitor under common law or statutory indemnity?
It would present a closer question if you had an exclusive importer who is a manufacturer strictly because of the federal CPSC statute, but yet made no attempt to exhibit the product or stimulate sales. I mean, if you had an importer who all they do is import it, they don't show up at any exhibitions, they don't advertise, they're not listed on a website, perhaps that might be a closer question. But here we have someone who's not merely an importer, a conduit. As Mr. Lee said, they were created to do a marketing job, and do what they do. The only way you can get them in the United States is to call them.
Is producer the only term in the definition of manufacturer under which Gladstone USA falls? Is that your argument?
for the purposes of the statute, I think that's the one that most closely applies, yes.
If it were proven that Tianjin Seiko manufactured all of these lighters, would your position change that Gladstone USA is still the manufacturer?
No, because as we've recognized in the Huttyberg and the other cases, there may be several companies that qualify as a manufacturer. For example, Gladstone Hong Kong may qualify because they created the design and they superintended the fabrication. The evidence is they basically said, they told Tian, of course, if you believe their story, they told Tianjin Seiko how to make it. They gave it the design. They said, you have to use our patented wheel, and this is where you go to get it. And, pardon me, they superintended in the sense that they checked out the molds for the parts, et cetera, et cetera. So you have the possibility that all three companies may qualify as manufacturers, and then you'll have to do a fact-intensive analysis under Huttyberg to determine who is the one who may end up bearing the entire loss.
Counsel, there's some question of counterfeiting.
I'm sorry?
There's some question of counterfeiting on these lighters. And as I understand, the lighter was completely destroyed?
There were two lighters purchased out of the same box. One was destroyed, one wasn't. Both of them, according to the witnesses, were identical. But as to the counterfeiting question,
you have one of them left.
Yes, it was Exhibit 2 to the Castillo deposition, and I think it was, photographs were attached to both of our responses.
They were different colors, though, weren't they?
Yes. Well, I think one was red and one was blue. The counterfeiting thing is basically sheer speculation by Mr. Lee. They said, we believe, we think. They haven't got any proof whatsoever that anybody is counterfeiting their lighters.
Mr. Hughes, your time has expired.
Yes.
We'll hear from Ms. Henderson.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Henderson, and I'm here on behalf of SSP Partners. I'd like to talk about the single business enterprise and its application to Chapter 82. I realize this court has heard arguments and is considering the single business enterprise in the PHC Minden case. And in that case, both sides seem to agree with critics of the single business enterprise that this court ought to not adopt it because of its similarities to alter ego or because its elements are too imprecise or nebulous. Of course, critics say the same thing about the elements of alter ego and its variable application. I think it'll help to recall the original purposes of limited corporate liability and alter ego to understand why the single business enterprise and its proper application will not dilute that. Of course, limited corporate liability was born as a way to encourage investment in corporate America by average moral individuals without risk of losing their investment because of corporate decisions from which they are removed. Alter ego, the genesis of it, was a recognition that there are some investors who abuse that limited liability shield and they ought to be held accountable. So alter ego originally, as it was created, was a means of going vertically through a corporation to its shareholders for their acts. Single business enterprise, however, was not born of these same concerns. Single business enterprise, in its original uses, was more of a means of reaching out horizontally to another entity or an individual who, because of the relationship between the two, ought to be held jointly liable for a debt. The earliest cases applying...
The problem is the ought part. How do we know when it ought to be?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because with alter ego, the ought is fraud.
That's right? Correct.
And so what is the ought here?
Part of the problem is the single business enterprise doctrine has been used in so many different ways, perhaps not consistent with its original purpose, that there is a mixing of the two doctrines. But the earliest cases using single business enterprise, the Paramount Petroleum case, which relied upon the 1969 Murphy case, what they were really doing is they're finding that two entities are not really acting as separate entities. They're acting as one. And that's the difference between single business enterprise and alter ego. Now, the court may say, well, we have other theories such as joint venture or joint enterprise or some of those other theories that have already been accepted. Why can't you rely on those? But in a single business enterprise, as it's applied, you don't have the mutual or equal right of control like you would in a joint enterprise or joint venture. In a single business enterprise, you have one company that's really nothing more than an arm of another, and that's what we have in this case. We have Gladstrong USA, which has no separate identity from Gladstrong Hong Kong.
All subsidiaries are one arm of the other.
That's correct, Honor, but usually a subsidiary has its own separate goals. It's trying to grow independently as a company, whereas in this case, Gladstrong USA does not have any separate business other than Gladstrong Hong Kong. They're not trying to make their own profit. They're not trying to grow independently of Hong Kong. It would be different if Gladstrong USA...
So you can only have subsidiaries if they're in a different business from the parent?
Not necessarily, no. Of course, subsidiaries can be in the same business, but usually they have their own separate...
All kinds of regulations, you got to have, a local corporation do it. So if one corporation has subs in every 50 states that do its identical business, and they send all the profits to the parent corporation every year, single business enterprise. You just can't do that.
I think the problem is you have to look at what goal you're trying to accomplish with the doctrine. You just can't look at the structure of the companies and decide whether it's single business enterprise.
So what's your goal? What point are you going to invoke this?
Okay. Single business enterprise would be, it is useful and it serves the purpose that it was intended to serve when you have a company like Gladstrong Hong Kong, or I'm sorry, Gladstrong USA. They don't buy the lighters from Hong Kong. What they're doing is they're selling Hong Kong's lighters. They're placing them into the stream of commerce, taking in the money and funneling it straight back to Hong Kong. It's not as if they were purchasing them from Hong Kong and then reselling them for a profit, and both companies are trying to grow independently of each other. That's why we had to rely upon it in this case, because here you have an innocent retailer and distributor trying to collect indemnity. The manufacturers in China, and we, of course, allege Hong Kong is the manufacturer, there's a U.S. branch office here who it has a separate corporate identity on paper, although that's a little bit murky because based on Mr. Lee's testimony, you can't really tell who owns this USA company. But in essence, they do nothing more than work for Hong Kong. In the context of Chapter 82, this makes sense because to be a manufacturer, it's not enough to simply process or formulate or fabricate the product. The second part of the definition requires you place it into the stream of commerce.
Ms. Henderson, why hasn't your client waived this corporate veil piercing argument?
Well, we pled single business enterprise and as well as alter ego and several other doctrines. The problem is after discovery was commenced in the case, we realized that we're not piercing vertically through Gladstrong Hong Kong. We're not trying to reach the shareholders of Gladstrong Hong Kong. We are saying that Gladstrong USA, for all intents and purposes, is the manufacturer. They're deemed the manufacturer under federal law. They were sued as the manufacturer by the plaintiffs in this case, in both their original petition and their amended petition. Now, for purposes of indemnity, they come in and say, we're not Hong Kong.
And so what's the reason why you did not seek indemnity from Gladstrong Hong Kong?
We did try to bring in Gladstrong Hong Kong.
The trial judge denied it.
It was denied twice.
Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Henderson. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Michael Choi, will present argument from the respondent.
Ms. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the apparent manufacturer doctrine has never been applied in any court in the country, as far as we can tell, to an indemnity claim, and for good reason. Under the Texas statute, of course, there is nothing in the definition of manufacturer that includes the concept of an apparent manufacturer, somebody who holds themselves out as the manufacturer. Other states have, in enacting these indemnity statutes, have provided for such additions and expansions of the definition of manufacturer. Texas deliberately chose not to do so. And if that wasn't clear enough, the legislature in 2003, when they passed 82003 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, made it clear that a non-manufacturing seller cannot be held liable unless the plaintiff can prove various things, none of which is that the seller held itself out as the manufacturer. So it's contrary to the policy, and it's contrary to the statute, and it's contrary to the policy of Texas.
But what would be wrong with that? What would be wrong with, because clearly Chapter 82 was designed to supplement the common law. You'd agree with that? I mean, it says so by its own terms. And what would be wrong if someone is putting a product out under a name that is confusing to the consumer and the consumer relies on that name in light of the purposes Chapter 82 was designed to serve, which is to protect an innocent retailer against a manufacturer? What would be wrong if the circumstances warranted it with applying that doctrine here?
Your Honor, the purposes of Chapter 82, the indemnity in general, the purposes are twofold. One, it is to ensure that the actual party who is responsible for the harm has the liability, has the loss shifted to them. In that case, that is the manufacturer, not somebody else in the chain of distribution. And again,
but if you're holding yourself out as the manufacturer, if you're creating a confusion, if Sears puts its name on the washing machine that you buy, isn't it getting the benefits of being perceived as being the manufacturer without having to suffer the detriments vis-a-vis an innocent retailer?
Well, the question there then would be, who is getting the benefit of that? In the case of where you're going to Sears and you're purchasing a washing machine that says Sears on it, the consumer has nothing to go on other than the product itself. And that's why the apparent manufacturer doctrine may be applicable in that case, to hold Sears liable as though they're the manufacturer. In this case, a distributor such as Circle K can contract with
I understand. What I'm questioning, though, your argument seems to be that because of Chapter 82, apparent manufacturer doesn't apply, period. And my question is, why shouldn't it if 82 was designed to supplement the common law? And I think you're telling me in an appropriate case it might.
Well, Your Honor, I think with the enactment of 82003, the legislature has made it clear that apparent manufacturer is dead and gone. I mean, it's an idea whose time has never come in the state of Texas, because they deliberately said, here are the points, here are the grounds on which a non-manufacturing seller can be held liable in any case. And nowhere in that statute do they say somebody who holds themselves out as the manufacturer of a product.
But now, they say it supplements the common law. And so if the common law has the apparent manufacturer doctrine, the argument is
82002 says that it, you know, it does not intend to encompass all areas of indemnity, such as purely vicarious liability, where parties contract by liability. I think, though, that the court should, in deciding what the common law is, should look to the policy as set forth by the legislature. And the legislature has made it clear that innocent retailers, including those who are upstream in the even those who may hold themselves out, are not to be held liable for a defect in a product unless there's some basis for independent liability. Now, if a party can come forth and bring some indication that they relied on a misrepresentation and that therefore they suffered harm as a result of that reliance, that would be a legitimate grounds potentially for some liability. Now, there's nothing of that in this case. Now, SSP and Metro agree that under the common law and common law indemnity, that you're required to have, you're required to establish a chain of distribution between the party seeking indemnity and the party from whom you seek indemnity from. But you can't have a chain if there aren't any links. And there is no evidence in this record of any link between Gladstrong USA and SSP or Metro. There's not one shred of evidence.
But they couldn't get the lighter from anybody else, could they? They get the lighter from anybody else.
There's no evidence to suggest that that's the case, Your Honor.
Not evidence that this is an exclusive distributor.
The only evidence in this case is the evidence from Ms. Lee, who says that she was told by the manufacturer that they were an exclusive distributor of the lighter. There's no evidence that, in fact, they were the exclusive distributor.
Well, and that's pretty close.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's pretty close, isn't it?
Well,
the manufacturer tells you you're the only seller. What else is there? How else would you prove it?
You could prove it by showing that SSP or Metro, who they purchased the lighters from. I mean, we're talking about a company that has hundreds of stores in the state of Texas. Certainly they have records of who they purchased their products from, and you need to establish that there's some connection between the purchase of the product and who they purchase it from. I think when you look back at indemnity, generally, that indemnity is a policy that derives from the law of contracts. When it historically, you could not get indemnity unless there was an express contractual provision. Ultimately, indemnity became an implied contract, where if there were two parties who had contracted with each other, and there was evidence that they contracted with each other, there was sort of an implied agreement that the party supplying the product would indemnify the party who was receiving the product. They would sort of stand behind the product.
I think the court understands all that, but why isn't what the manufacturer told this lady good enough?
Well, let me
step, why isn't that some evidence?
Let me step back a little bit just to say that the only evidence in this case has to do with Gladstrong Hong Kong. All of the representations, all the statements that they refer to in the record all have to do with Gladstrong Hong Kong only.
Why would Gladstrong USA settle for $1.6 million if it didn't distribute the lighter?
Your Honor, for the same reason that all parties settle lawsuits, because they didn't want to take on the risk. They were down in the valley facing a five-year-old child who burned to death. I can't fault Gladstrong USA at all for settling this lawsuit.
Well, $1.6 million seems like a lot if you didn't sell the lighter.
Well, Your Honor, again, you're dealing with risk, and there are multitude of reasons why parties settle lawsuits. Given the circumstances of this case, I certainly can't fault them for settling it, even if I believe that they didn't have any liability, and potentially they didn't think so either.
Counsel, did you say Ms. Lee's statement that the manufacturer said Gladstone Hong Kong was the sole distributor, or Gladstone USA was the sole distributor?
I believe her testimony in that one instance covered both. Her testimony was that Gladstrong Hong Kong was told by Tianjin Seiko that they were the exclusive distributor of the wax lighter. And so I think that would be fair to carry down to Gladstrong USA, because there isn't any evidence that Gladstrong USA received products other than from Gladstrong Hong Kong. But in any event, the representations dealing with whether Gladstrong Hong Kong was the manufacturer cannot be attributed to Gladstrong USA. Gladstrong Hong Kong is not a party to this case. As Ms. Henderson pointed out, they tried to get Gladstrong Hong Kong into the case because it was untimely. The trial court denied their motion to join Gladstrong Hong Kong, and there's been no appeal from that ruling. So to whatever extent Gladstrong Hong Kong, those claims may still be valid against them, they can certainly bring claims against Gladstrong Hong Kong. They can bring claims against the manufacturer. And in fact, they sued the manufacturer, brought third-party claims against Tianjin Seiko. Those claims, as of the time of the summary judgments, were still pending. There's no need to bring to expand single business enterprise or any other alter ego theory to get to Gladstrong USA. The purpose behind single business enterprise, the core purpose behind it, is when you have one party who has debts that it owes to the plaintiff, but for whatever reason you can't get to that party, there, you want to disregard the corporate formalities to be able to get to the assets of somebody else. And there's no need for that doctrine here. Furthermore, there's no evidence in this case that Gladstrong USA and Gladstrong Hong Kong were operated or maintained as separate business entities, which is the core evidence that you need to get to the single business enterprise theory. That's the whole purpose behind that doctrine. As this court held in BMC Software, evidence that there are shared directors, that there are shared employees, that they're, even if they have the same accounting system, that's no evidence that the two corporate entities should not recognize the corporate separateness of those two entities.
Wasn't there evidence that Gladstrong Hong Kong gave money to USA to reimburse the customers for the recall by the Consumer Product Safety Commission?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And again, Gladstrong USA, as an importer of these lighters, was under the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Consumer Product Safety Act, was responsible for pulling in the, issuing the recall. They did so, and But the fact that Gladstrong Hong Kong reimbursed those expenses.
And did USA hold itself out in filings with the UCC and with the Consumer Product Safety?
Not Gladstrong USA, Your Honor. Gladstrong Hong Kong. Again, the evidence there is only as to Gladstrong Hong Kong holding itself out. And again, there is no confusion or reliance on the part of the consumers, or even in this case, on the part of SSP or Metro. There's no evidence that anybody at SSP or Metro ever referred to the website, referred to these UCC filings, or had any basis. In fact, there's no evidence that they bought these lighters from Gladstrong USA or from Gladstrong Hong Kong.
Over there, what about the counterfeiting and the bootleg lighter question that's been raised?
There was evidence, Your Honor, that was raised that had to do with, I believe it was from Mr. Lee's testimony, that there had been reports of counterfeiting and there had been these other wax lighters. And again, that goes back to the notion that they were told that they were the exclusive distributor of these wax lighters, but there was no evidence that would be sufficient to show this link. Now, I mean, Your Honor, supposing I went out onto 6th Street and I set up a card table somewhere where I was selling $10 watches that said Rolex on them. Now, somebody comes and buys a watch, and they get injured as a result of it, and they sue me. Now, under SSP and Metro's theory...
That's not a very good analogy. You're talking about a very expensive watch being sold for $10. I think most people with common sense realize that's not a Rolex. What you have here are lighters, which are primarily look all the same, quite frankly. You flick it, it lights. It's supposed to light, so... You know, try to come up with a different analogy.
Well, even if it's for $1,000, Your Honor, the point is the mere fact that it has some, you know, in that hypothetical, the mere fact that it has some marking on it that says Rolex on it, and the fact that I then sold it to it, under their theory, I can bring an indemnity claim. I could find out who the distributor of Rolex watches is in the city of Austin, and I can bring an indemnity claim against them, and I can get past summary judgment, even though there's no evidence that I ever had any interaction whatsoever with the Rolex distributor. And that's not what the law of Texas should be, because indemnity is based on a theory that there needs to be some link in the chain between the party that's seeking indemnity and the party that's ultimately to be held responsible, which should be the manufacturer, not anybody else up the chain.
Is there any serious dispute as to the origin of the lighter that caused the fire? I mean, you mentioned there are two lighters, one a red one, blue, and same lighter, essentially, that came from HK?
I don't know that I can answer that based on this record as to whether there's a dispute that the lighter that was in the fire itself was the wax lighter that was sold at the Circle K. There may have been some issues raised in the trial court as to whether or not this lighter was the one that caused the fire as opposed to some other lighter because of the fact that the lighter burned up in the fire. But I don't know that I can answer that question, Justice Green, based on the record that's before us here.
On the issue of consumer confusion, what about the argument that consumer confusion, the consumer's perception of who the manufacturer was, it may be important or is important to liability between the plaintiff and the liability of the defendant to the plaintiff, but consumer confusion is not really that important, the argument goes, when you're talking about indemnity as between innocent seller and manufacturer, because what does consumer confusion have to do with that issue? What about that position?
Well, I think that pretty accurately states it, is that the concept of consumer confusion, the concept of apparent manufacturer is built on the idea of consumer confusion, that an individual consumer has nothing to go on other than the product itself. And so, therefore, if they are led to believe that a product is manufactured by that a washing machine is manufactured by Sears, they're going to rely on that name and they're going to purchase it based on that name. And so, therefore, the apparent manufacturer doctrine goes: you should be able to hold Sears liable, even though they're not the actual manufacturer, because of the fact that the consumer was potentially confused. In the case of an indemnity claim where a sophisticated seller such as Circle K or anybody who's in the chain of distribution knows where the source of their products are, they can pick and choose who they agree to purchase products from. And so, therefore, there's no danger of confusion as to who the real manufacturer of. If they get a lighter that has a name on it, they'll know who they actually purchased that lighter from, and so they won't have the danger of being confused as to who is the real manufacturer. In addition, unlike the plaintiff in a straightforward, you know, the consumer or the end user of the product, the seller or retailer has the ability to upfront contract and receive indemnity through contract, something that's not available to the plaintiff in this case. Another thing that a consumer can, or that a retailer or a seller can do if they're concerned about foreign companies that they may not be able to attach a jurisdiction to and get indemnity, they can choose not to carry foreign-made products. So these are options that are available to sellers and retailers, which SSP and Metro did not take advantage of. And so they're asking the court to bail them out.
In this global economy, how would one decide not to sell products not manufactured overseas? Seems like that's not a very easy thing to do.
Well, it may be difficult, Your Honor, but I know that that's something that stores can do as a matter of policy. And in fact, I would suggest to you that given the current global political climate, that might be something that they use as a marketing tool, if they think that that will be advantageous for whoever their potential consumers are. But again, that's something that they have available to them, an option which is not available to the consumer, which is why.
Is there something that precludes this court? Is there a law, or does Chapter 82 preclude this court from adopting apparent manufacturing as a permissible common law indemnity scheme?
I believe that Chapter 82003 expresses some clear legislative policy that non-selling manufacturers are not to be held liable in any event, under whether to the plaintiff or whether under an indemnity claim.
Does that preclude this court from adopting apparent manufacturing as another way of reaching common law indemnity?
Your Honor, I don't know that I can say no, but what it would result in is you would have this sliver of cases in which they were brought before the effective date of the 2003 Act, in which, for whatever reason, limitations hasn't run yet, in which that common law doctrine would apply. And I think it would just be a waste of the court's resources to then potentially cause confusion in the courts of appeals and the trial courts as to whether or not that doctrine applies or whether or not the statute applies. It makes a lot more sense for this court to just follow the policy as set forth by the legislature and conform the common law to that, to what I think the legislature has spoken with unmistakable clarity, which is that non-manufacturing sellers should not be held liable unless there's some basis for establishing that they are responsible for the harm that was caused in the product. And there's no evidence of that here with respect to Gladstrong USA, certainly. And again, if there's a claim to bring against the manufacturer in this case, Tianjin Seiko, or even if there's a claim to be brought against Gladstrong Hong Kong, they have the opportunity to do that and had the opportunity to do that. And that's where indemnity should lie.
What about the argument that upstream manufacturers, distributors, are better able to protect themselves than downstream?
Well, I would disagree with it on the facts of this case because you're dealing with a very sophisticated retailer in Circle K stores. But that's sort of, there's an economic argument about pushing it upstream. But fundamentally, the doctrine of indemnity, the purposes of indemnity are to place the loss on the party who is ultimately responsible, and that is the manufacturer of the product, not someone else who's upstream. I think the result of a policy like that is going to just lead to extra litigation because then each party up the stream is going to be suing each other. In this case, we could potentially have five lawsuits. Plaintiff sues SSP, SSP sues Metro, Metro sues Gladstrong USA, Gladstrong USA sues Gladstrong Hong Kong, Gladstrong Hong Kong sues Tianjin Seiko. That doesn't seem to me to be sound policy. The policy should be, let's place the loss on the party who is responsible for the loss, the true manufacturer of the product.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. Court will hear rebuttal.
Mr. Hughes, real quick, looking at Chapter 82, is there any record evidence at all that Gladstrong USA was involved in helping assemble this lighter?
In the sense that I take the question to be, did they assemble the lighter or fabricate it? No. The best you can say is they placed the order and they act as the importers to get it through customs, and then they go out and stimulate orders for it. And maybe assist in getting the product delivered. But in the sense of putting anything together, no. I'd like to go back to the question about applying this definition to the statute. Many other jurisdictions have completely preempted the common law with a statutory scheme. Federal courts in three of those jurisdictions have stated that the doctrine of applied manufacture will be applied to the definition of who is a manufacturer under those statutes, which is important because under many of those schemes, as we have just done, the intermediate innocent retailers are all let out, and essentially you're left with a statutory claim only against the manufacturer, assuming you can get there. This problem is important to Texas because after 2003, the distribution chain will remain in the case if you have a foreign manufacturer who cannot be made subject to U.S. jurisdiction. We didn't get Hong Kong in this case, even though Metro tried to bring them in within 30 or 40 days after it filed its answer. The problem was it was on the eve of trial, and the trial court didn't want to disrupt the trial date. If you can't bring in Gladstrong Hong Kong because they are in Hong Kong and outside the jurisdiction, and you have the PHC Minden case before you now about whether you can attribute Gladstrong USA's contacts. If all those fall in favor of Gladstrong Hong Kong, nobody will ever get to them. And we will be back to the question of then, should Gladstrong USA be held liable as a manufacturer because it held itself out to be so? And therefore, it's still an important question.
You're not saying that a company that's in the chain, taking away single business enterprise, alter ego, and all that, that the ones that you can reach, somebody at the top of the distribution chain, before you get to the foreign manufacturer, should somehow be liable just because of that?
Under the common law, I think they would owe common law indemnity without regard to the apparent manufacturer. Under the statute, then you would have to use one of the common law doctrines such as single business enterprise, alter ego, if it's available, or apparent manufacturer to hold them liable as a manufacturer, assuming those doctrines apply.
So it would have to be through one of those devices?
Yes. Otherwise, simply being a distributor, no, because the 8203 is very clear that it says a seller who does not manufacture has to be let out unless, and one of them, of course, is if you have a foreign manufacturer not subject to jurisdiction. So if all they do is distribute it without manufacturing it, then they would be out under the statute, and you would need some other doctrine to attribute them to become a manufacturer.
How do you respond to the contention that consumer confusion under the apparent manufacturer doctrine is not as important, at least, when you're talking about indemnity between manufacturer and seller, as it is for the plaintiff's ability to recover?
Well, I think that's based on a silent assumption that somehow distributors are sophisticated and not gullible, and consumers are gullible and not sophisticated. But their entire business strategy was based on exactly the opposite assumption. Their business strategy was on, and I use the word loosely, duping people into believing they were dealing direct with the manufacturer and thereby getting the cheapest price. That was their business strategy. I don't think they would adopt it if they didn't think it wouldn't work. And in fact, their website advertises that they have $10 to $14 million in sales. So I think we can assume that distributors can be taken just as easily as the consumer. But again, I get back to that under the restatement, it's the potential for confusion, not the fact of it, that drives the doctrine. It's not an element. It's simply a policy justification for applying the doctrine in the first place.
Are there other questions? Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.